Today is Wednesday, January 5th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Gene Roper, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, the U.S. East Coast digs out of a blizzard that shuts federal buildings and even delayed Air Force One.
After landing at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland, Biden remained on Air Force One for at least 30 minutes so the tarmac could be plowed.
Also ahead, South Korean president vows to use his last month in office to press for a diplomatic breakthrough with North Korea.
South Korea, for several years now, has really been optimistic about the idea of reaching agreements and sort of furthering this peace process with North Korea.
More than 4,400 migrants, including at least 205 children, lost at sea trying to reach Spain in 2021. These stories and more are next. More than 4,400 migrants, including at least 205 children, were lost at sea trying to reach Spain in 2021, a monitoring group said on Monday, more than double the figure from the previous year and the most since the group began counting in 2018. The group, Walking Borders, or Caminado Fronteras, blamed increasingly dangerous routes, inferior boats, and the fear of some vessels to help migrants at sea for the surge in deaths. According to Spanish official statistics, 39,000 undocumented migrants successfully reached Spain by sea or land last year, a similar figure to the previous year. Walking Borders said more than 90% of those missing or dead were lost on 125 shipwrecks en route to Spain's Canary Islands in the Atlantic Ocean as of December 20th. Since 2020, the island off the coast of Africa have become the main destination of migrants trying to reach Spain, with a much smaller share trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to the Spanish mainland. Helena Milano, founder of Caminado Fronteras, told Reuters the group gathered its data from hotlines set up for migrants on vessels in trouble to call for help and from family members seeking information. The United Nations International Organization for Migration counted 955 people who died or went missing in 2021 trying to reach the Canary Islands by December 22nd, the highest figure documented since 2014. The winter's first blizzard pounded the nation's capital Monday, shutting federal buildings and even delaying Air Force One, and knocked out power from the Carolinas to New Jersey. Lisa Barnhart of Reuters produced this report.
A winter storm unleashed heavy snow and strong winds throughout much of the southeast and mid-Atlantic states on Monday, forcing federal offices and schools to close, grounding airplanes, and knocking out power for thousands of people. Even President Joe Biden faced delays as he arrived back in Washington from Delaware. After landing at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland, Biden remained on Air Force One for at least 30 minutes so the tarmac could be plowed. The president eventually descended the snowy staircase, shielding his face as blizzard-like conditions whipped around him. His motorcade, which typically darts through Washington streets, crawled its way back to the White House. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser declared a snow emergency as public transportation in and around the city was operating on a reduced schedule and faced delays. She also implored people to stay off the slick roads. The region's first winter blizzard could dump 4 to 8 inches of snow and packs 40-mile-an-hour winds, with severe weather warnings stretching from the Carolinas to New Jersey. Some 770,000 customers were without power in Virginia, Maryland, the Carolinas, and Georgia. And as of midday, 2,400 flights were canceled and 2,900 were delayed.
That's Lisa Bernhardt of Reuters. As the Capitol riot anniversary approaches, the Senate's chief says lawmakers will vote on a rules change to advance stalled voting rights legislation. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Democrats have been pushing an elections law package they say is needed to protect democracy. And for months, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's complained about Republican opposition in August.
Even on an issue as sacred as the right to vote.
And October.
Every single Republican senator.
Saying they've kept the evenly split Senate from even debating the legislation. Schumer says in coming days, the Senate will vote on changing filibuster rules, which would let Democrats advance the bill without 60 votes. He says the Senate must reform democracy to avoid a repeat of the Capitol attack. Sagar Magani, Washington.
With the arrival of 2022, millions of Americans are setting off on a journey to meet their New Year's resolution and goals they've set for themselves. The Mayo Clinic recommends setting SMART goals, meaning goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time limited. A common New Year's resolution is vowing to lose weight, something that U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that roughly half of all Americans make. The CDC notes the most common approach to losing weight is eating less and exercising more. VOA Steve Miller spoke with Dr. Ranjan Misra, an internal medicine physician in San Francisco, about what to keep in mind when exercising indoors with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus still prevalent.
Well, I think at this point, we know that most places in America are having, you know, somewhat of a surge in cases and infections and hospitalizations because of the vastly present Omicron variant of the coronavirus. So we need to remember that we have to employ what works, and we know what works. It's masking and it's cleaning your hands, whether that's washing your hands or sanitizing it with a hand sanitizer. But we do need to employ both of those as we now go into the new year and we're in a surge. If you're vaccinated, obviously we know that and you get infected with Omicron, we know that your symptoms are going to be pretty mild, like the mild flu. But it's the people who are unvaccinated, they are the people who are having more of a severe illness. They're the people who are ending up on respirators in the hospital. I was hoping that the numbers would be a little better, but at this point, only 62% of the population is actually fully vaccinated, and only 34% have had the booster. So those numbers could be a lot higher, and I think if they were a lot higher, people just would be safer overall.
And I just want to clarify, those numbers represent vaccination status and unvaccinated status within the United States. You mentioned masks, and I want to ask you this question. Within the United States and elsewhere around the world, some places have mask mandates in place and some don't. What does the science say about wearing a mask?
So in a case like this, Steve, I think of the, you know, common sense. We know that masking protects us. We know masking protects other people. And so whether or not it's mandated in your area, it's important to remember that this is a very, very simple thing that we can all do to not only protect ourselves, but the people around us. Now, having said that, a lot of people, of course, that I've seen are wearing cloth masks. They're wearing the scarves that you can just pull over your mouth. And then some of the medical grade blue masks that you can see. Given how contagious the Omicron variant is, there is now a recommendation that you employ the use of K95 or N95 masks, because they're better at protecting.
Okay, and one last question. As research continues on the Omicron variant and on the coronavirus itself, what things are you keeping an eye on in terms of the research that is emerging in the next weeks or coming months?
Well, I think what we're keeping an eye out on is when this is going to start to have a decline. This particular variant was first found in South Africa, and they had a pretty sharp incline and a peak, and then it was a pretty rapid decline too. So we're hoping that, you know, we experience the same thing in the next couple of weeks. I think epidemiologists are forecasting that we're going to be hitting our peak soon, and then hopefully the cases go down after that.
That's Dr. Ranjan Misra, an internal medicine physician practicing in San Francisco, California, speaking to VOA Steve Miller. South Korean President Moon Jae-in vowed on Monday to use his last months in office to press for a diplomatic breakthrough with North Korea, despite public silence from Pyongyang over his attempt for a declaration of peace between the two sides. This, as Washington and Seoul have agreed in principle to sign an, quote, end of war declaration, unquote, ending decades of inter-Korean conflict. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price recently said the administration harbors no hostile intent and is ready to engage in talks without precondition. In his own address on New Year's Eve, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made no mention of Moon's calls for a declaration officially ending the 1950 to 1953 Korean War or of stalled denuclearization talks with the United States. For more, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
South Korea, for several years now, has really been optimistic about the idea of reaching agreements and sort of furthering this peace process with North Korea. However, in order for that to happen, North Korea really has to be on board, because the U.S. and South Korea may have an agreement on the end of war declaration or something related to the end of war. But the U.S. and South Korea are not at war with each other. That involves North Korea. So you'd have to get them to sign on. Regarding what the U.S. stance is in all of this, the U.S. officials are actually sort of reluctant to talk about this. They just repeat talking points, mostly when asked about it. It seems that the U.S., though, is sort of just being a good ally and listening, partaking in this process. I do believe there is likely a draft text to end the Korean War that the United States and South Korea have worked out. I do not believe that the U.S. wants to talk about that, in part because not so many people in the U.S. government actually believe it would be effective or actually would work to sort of advance the peace process in North Korea. The other thing is there's an election coming up in South Korea in a couple months. And if the conservatives win, any sort of end of war declaration or even just the idea of engagement with North Korea becomes a lot less likely. They typically take a much harder stance toward North Korea. So I think the U.S. is more in wait and see mode at this point when it comes to this effort.
But to have come out so openly to talk about signing this without getting the North involved, is the U.S. kind of baiting North Korea or just pressuring North Korea to come on board?
The main sort of impetus for all of this is coming from South Korea, to be clear. I think the U.S. is willing to say in some sort of some settings that, sure, they are working on this. They're open to the idea. But really, the effort to push for this end of war declaration is coming from South Korea. And I guess it is an attempt to sort of, I don't know if bait is the right word involving North Korea, but I guess entice them. This approach was used repeatedly by the South Korean administration during the Donald Trump presidency. They would occasionally leak different details about talks with North Korea or some effort with North Korea in an effort to sort of get it talked about in international news headlines. I think back then there was this idea that perhaps the presidency of Donald Trump and Donald Trump himself was more sort of susceptible to seeing news headlines and sort of waking up and sort of basing policy around that. That worked very well for the South Korean administration during the Trump administration. Basically, it resulted in a series of talks with Kim Jong-un, even to the point where Donald Trump would sort of just out of nowhere schedule talks, do a meeting on the demilitarized zone with Kim Jong-un. I think a lot of that you can sort of credit South Korea. Whether this will work or not with the end of war declaration is really another question, though, mainly because the presidential administration here in South Korea only has a few more months in office.
What's the big deal about signing this armistice? Although the war ended almost decades ago, but no war, no shooting war is actually going on. So why is this such a big deal to have this document signed?
To be clear, there is a debate about this, whether or not it would be a big deal. A big part of the question is, what form does this document take? Is it an end of war declaration? Is it sort of something that formally seals the deal? Or is it just a piece of paper that says that the war is over? Because as you mentioned, this has not been a hot war for many, many decades. Tensions occasionally flare up and people have died. But the last time there were significant deaths as a result of the Korean War has been quite a long time ago. Now, sort of the argument for it is that in coming to an agreement to formally end the Korean War, this could perhaps serve as some sort of catalyst for talks with North Korea, that perhaps they would feel more comfortable moving forward in talks if they know they had a piece of paper that said the U.S. is not at war with them, they're committed to peace, and they could reference that and move forward from there. However, there is concerns, especially on the U.S. side here, that if they come to an end of war agreement, that this would sort of eliminate the need for the U.S. military presence in South Korea. I don't know how many people are aware of it, but there are about 28,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. If the war is ended, I think there are concerns that in the U.S. that perhaps people would say, well, why are the troops still there? Which is a good question. But if this paper hasn't actually changed anything on the ground as far as the calculus between the U.S. and South Korea, then I think it would be sort of people think it would be sort of dangerous to talk about then removing U.S. troops.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah militia verbally attacked Saudi Arabia in a Monday evening speech, accusing the Gulf Kingdom of helping spread Islamic extremism around the globe and holding Lebanon, quote, hostage, unquote. Analysts say that Hezbollah's firing with Saudi Arabia deprives Lebanon of needed financial help. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Iran-backed Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah launched a broadside against the Saudi king in televised remarks. Your Highness the King, the terrorist is the side who exported Daesh ideology to the world, and they are you, Nasrallah said, referring to the Islamic State group, as known by its Arabic name. He also accused Saudi Arabia of sending Saudi suicide attackers to Syria and Iraq, as well as for the war in Yemen. Last week, Saudi King Salman urged the Lebanese to end what he called the terrorist Hezbollah's control of Lebanon. Many Lebanese had hoped that the resignation of their former information minister would have ended the war of words between the two sides, but Nasrallah opened old wounds. Habib Malik, history professor at the Lebanese American University, points to Shiite Hezbollah's alleged attempts to proliferate drugs in the Gulf through fake fruit exports. He told VOA that Hezbollah also sends regular trainers, weapons, and personnel to Yemen to help the Houthi rebels against the Saudis, and it does Iran's bidding in Lebanon.
Nasrallah said that it's Saudi Arabia that has been behind Sunni radicalism and Daesh, especially in Iraq. I'm not whitewashing the Saudi record either. There is some truth in that. But one form of violation doesn't justify the other. This recurring attack on the Gulf and Saudi Arabia shows that Hezbollah could care less about the hundreds of thousands of Lebanese working in the Gulf who could easily be adversely affected by this kind of rhetoric. Hezbollah doesn't care about Lebanon or its interests. Hezbollah is simply carrying out the instructions and directives of an alien foreign country whose aim is to expand at any cost in the region.
Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Makati criticized Nasrallah, saying it is not in Lebanon's interest to offend any Arab country, especially the Gulf states. Arab Gulf states have generously helped cash-strap Lebanon in the past. Critics blame Hezbollah for damaging ties with the Gulf, which has stopped financial assistance due to Iran's meddling in Lebanon's affairs. Over the past 2 years, Lebanon has experienced economic, political, fuel, power, and social crises, described by the World Bank as the most severe in the world. The Lebanese currency has lost more than 90% of its value, and 4 out of 5 Lebanese now live under the United Nations poverty threshold. Political observer Baria Alamuddin, writing in the Saudi Arab News newspaper, attributes Lebanon's worsening situation in part to Iran and Hezbollah, which, over the past 16 years, has wielded enormous influence. Hezbollah dominates the state, she recently wrote, but exists outside the principles and values of the state and undermines the state's sovereignty and legitimacy. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
In Mali, a coalition of political parties has rejected the military government's plan for a 5-year transition before elections. Mali has been under pressure from West African governments to hold elections since a May military coup d'etat, the second in less than a year. Analysts weigh in on the significance of the military's pushing of civilian rule. Annie Rosenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's military leaders recently released a new timetable for the transition period to regional bloc ECOWAS, proposing a 5-year plan that calls for the next presidential elections to be held in 2026. The transition was originally projected to last 18 months, after a military junta headed by current President Assimi Goïta first took power in a coup that ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta in August of 2020. Elections were previously scheduled for this February. A coalition of major political parties in Mali released a letter rejecting the 5-year plan, having also boycotted 4 days of national meetings, which they say were only held so that the government could propose a longer transition. The spokesperson for the coalition, Amadou Keïta, says that the group is calling on current military leaders to respect the transition charter.
In transition, son objectif principal.
He says, the main goal of a transition is the end of the transition. It's to work for a return to constitutional order. Those who want to be in power should be candidates and submit to the will of the people. He says, we are a democracy. We are in a country where we have rights. We are a republic. Let's respect the law. One of the reasons given for the extension was the security situation, which has steadily declined for a decade. Doussouba Konaté, who works for the Mali Office of Accountability Lab, a transnational group that promotes good governance, says there is some truth to the claim that elections cannot be held due to insecurity. The insecurity argument is an argument that is really, really heavy, she says. It's an argument that is really going to play a part in this, because we're talking about democracy. What does democracy mean? Democracy means inclusivity, she says, and taking into consideration all of the Malian population. She She says, "We know very well that because of insecurity, there's a big part of the Malian population who won't be able to be taken into consideration in the next elections." Konate says that though many people oppose a longer period of military rule, some citizens support a longer transition because they appreciate seeing a Malian president who can confront the international community. But Mali's relationship with the international community, whether with its ECOWAS neighbors in ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, or with European countries, remains complicated. France recently pulled out of all but one of Mali's northern military bases, a decision French President Emmanuel Macron called a reorganization of its anti-insurgent Operation Barkhane forces, and which came after months of anti-French protests in Bamako. ECOWAS has threatened further sanctions on Mali if the military government cannot abide by a February election deadline. Nana Akufo-Addo, the current president of ECOWAS, is due to visit Mali Wednesday to discuss the transition timetable. An ECOWAS summit on Mali is scheduled for this Sunday in Accra. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
This is the Voice of America. A U.S.-led coalition official in Iraq says two explosive-laden drones that targeted a military base housing U.S. troops in western Anbar province have been destroyed. The official says the fixed-wing drones rigged with explosives were engaged by defensive capabilities at the Ain al-Assad Air Base and that the attack was unsuccessful. It was the second such attempted attack, coinciding with the anniversary of the 2020 U.S. airstrike that killed a top Iranian general. Sudanese pro-democracy groups are calling for mass anti-coup protests as the country plunges further into turmoil following the Prime Minister's resignation earlier this week. Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok was ousted in Sudan's October coup, only to be reinstated a month later following a deal with the military meant to calm tensions and anti-coup protests. He stepped down on Sunday amid political deadlock, saying he had failed to find a compromise between the ruling generals and the pro-democracy movement. Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam says the recent closure of two media outlets in the city does not indicate a decline in press freedom, as the decisions were made by the outlets themselves. Her comments came almost a week after authorities arrested seven people associated with pro-democracy online news outlet Stan News, with the outlet then announcing that it would cease operations.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you think of planets, you probably picture them orbiting a star. But did you know there's a classification of planets called rogue, orphan, or nomad planets? These are planets that are much like those in our solar system, but rather than orbiting any star and being part of a planetary system, they are free-floating in space. Not many of these reclusive planets have been found, so they are considered to be quite rare. The European Southern Observatory reports that scientists who use several of their telescopes as well as other facilities have spotted at least 70 rogue planets that make up what they consider to be the largest group of orphan planets in the Milky Way. It's believed that these objects have been ejected from their original home planetary system at some time in the distant past. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America, I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Kenyan authorities say they are pursuing suspected Al-Shabaab terrorists who killed six people early Monday in Lamu County on the border with Somalia. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Masharia says suspected Al-Shabaab militants attacked and killed villagers early Monday in the county's Widu area. However, there was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Masharia says they are pursuing the suspects into the forest. He says they might also be hiding among the population. Masharia says they are seeking the public's help to trace the criminals. Kenya's Citizen TV reported at least one victim was shot, one hacked to death with a machete, and others were burned alive. VOA could not independently verify the accounts. Widu area residents say the attackers also torched several houses, though some residents speaking to local media questioned if the violence was the work of the Islamist militants or related to local politics. The Nation media group quoted some locals saying most of the attackers were carrying machetes, whereas Al-Shabaab militants are commonly armed with guns. Masharia says they have deployed more security forces to the area.
But tumeongeza, we have beefed up security in the county.
He says they have beefed up security in the county and to make sure that Kenyans and their properties are safe. Al-Shabaab are known to hide out in the Boni Forest in northeast Kenya's Lamu County on the border with Somalia. The Somali terrorist group launches sporadic attacks on villages and public transport. On Saturday, a man riding a motorcycle was killed when he ran over a roadside bomb in the Kiungu area of Lamu on the border with Somalia near the Indian Ocean coast. Kenyan security officials blamed Al-Shabaab for setting off the explosives. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Conservationists are blaming climate change, land clearing and pesticides for the population crash of one of Australia's most famous insects. Once a common sight, bogong moths have become rare in recent years. They are now recognized as endangered by the world's leading scientific authority on vulnerable species, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The bogong moth is native to Australia. The mass migration of billions of the small insects has long been a spectacular sight in eastern Australia. Scientists say the moths are guided by the stars and the Earth's magnetic fields. They fly up to 1,000 kilometres from Queensland to the mountains of Victoria to shelter in caves from the heat of summer. In the caves, it was once estimated, there were as many as 17,000 moths per square metre. But Jess Abrahams, a nature campaigner from the Australian Conservation Foundation, says bogong moth numbers have collapsed.
It's a dramatic decline, and this population crash has been caused by climate change-fueled extreme drought in their breeding grounds in Western Queensland. There's also been land clearing over many years, use of pesticides as well, and the consequence is a huge crash in numbers, and the flow-on effects to other species is of huge concern. This should be an alarm bell, because we're in the midst of an extinction crisis. We're seeing million species globally at risk of extinction, and literally these things are disappearing before our very eyes.
The decline of the bogong moth has a cascading effect on other species. They were a major source of food for another critically endangered animal, the mountain pygmy possum. Fewer than 2,000 of Australia's only hibernating marsupials are thought to be left in the wild. The moth is one of 124 Australian animals and plants that were added in December to the Red List of Threatened Species, compiled by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. They include several other types of insects and the grey-headed flying fox, which is Australia's largest bat. The Red List classifies how close global animal, plant and fungi species are to dying out, and include sharks, rays and birds. Many populations are strained by global warming, deforestation, habitat loss and pollution. Campaigners are urging the Australian government to do more to save the moths that were once in such abundance in cities such as Sydney and Canberra that their vast numbers disrupted sporting events. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Today, for more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell Dawson, I am Chinedu Opo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba ba ba.